WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, happy Martin Luther King's birthday, everyone. And for this whole hour, we will play excerpts from our fifth annual WNYC Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum. We did it yesterday afternoon. My co-hosts were Terrence McKnight from our classical music sister station, WQXR, and Princeton political science professor Melissa Harris Perry. And we had some great panels and solo speakers and musicians. It was an intellectual afternoon, and it was also a celebratory afternoon. So we're happy to bring you some excerpts. The title of the event was King's Dream in Today's Economy. So let's begin with Aubrey Hendricks, professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He speaks here about Martin Luther King's economic consciousness developing even when he was in high school.
In fact, King's concern for economic rights showed itself while he was yet in his teens. His Morehouse classmate, Lerone Bennett of Ebony magazine fame, recalls that during summers off from college, King, the privileged preacher's kid, worked in factories, hauled furniture at a mattress company, and worked at Railway Express, not because he needed the money. Daddy King indulged whatever he wanted. But because, in Bennett's words, he wanted to learn about workers' problems and their feelings. This concern permeated King's ministry and his activism. It is often overlooked that the full title of the 1963 March on Washington was the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice. We all know King's iconic I Have a Dream address from that day, at least the last portion of it. Fewer of us know, though, that on that day, King also upbraided this nation for defaulting on its promise of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and justice for all, and warned that it would be fatal, that's King's word, fatal for the nation to overlook what he called the fierce urgency of now. Yet what is least well known yet is that in a sermon at Ebenezer Church just 2 years later, King confessed that he had seen his dream shattered, again, that's King's term, by his witnessing of increasing, not decreasing, poverty. Poverty that reached from the inner cities to the Mississippi Delta to the impoverished hollows of Appalachia. And on that Sunday morning, he told the congregation of the dreams that he now held. I still have a dream, he said, but his dream was now, quote, that one day all of God's children will have food and clothing and material well-being for their bodies. Then he made it clear to all assembled that economic rights were just as crucial for him as civil rights.
Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, a professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary, the first of our excerpts from yesterday's Martin Luther King Day event that we held at the Brooklyn Museum called King's Dream and Today's Economy. We're going to play another excerpt now from Dr. Hendricks, this on King's Dream and Economic Inequality. Dr. Hendricks remembers here the circumstances of Dr. King's death.
And let us not forget that on the day he drew his last breath, he was in Memphis only because some of those on the lowest rung of the social economic totem pole in Memphis, sanitation workers, who were black and garbage men, asked him to come to support their fight for a living wage. He died fighting that fight. That is who he was, and that is who we should remember him as and honor him as, the fullness of who he was, not the domesticated, watered-down, user-friendly, can't we just get along, Rodney King-esque figure that we see on coffee mugs and key rings.
Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, if you're just joining us, excerpts this hour from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum, King's Dream in Today's Economy. And another speaker was Tufts historian Peniel Joseph yesterday. This is a really interesting take on historical relationships between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and King and LBJ.
Dr. King is an American revolutionary. He's a black revolutionary. We usually juxtapose Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In my work, I don't do that. Those are two American and African-American revolutionaries whose work actually intersects with the anti-colonial moment of the post-World War II period. So both King and Malcolm are these anti-colonialists, these anti-imperialists, these activists for labor rights, and activists for Local 1199. So when we think about Dr. King, King is a genuine revolutionary who, in Birmingham in 1963, talks about America returning to the great wells of democracy that were dug deep by the founding fathers. King was being too generous. It's black Americans, it's white Americans, it's women, ethnic minorities, and labor that have historically dug those great wells of democracy the deepest. Black people have been the people who've lived in America the longest, who've had the right to vote for the least amount of time, who've believed and cherished in democracy more than any other group of people in the United States. Black people are the ones who bled for American democracy in the post-World War II period. Very quickly, in terms of the last 3 years of King's life, post-Selma, King, as one of his biographers has said, becomes a pillar of fire for economic justice. We teach our kids of a soft and fuzzy, a warm and fuzzy Dr. King. One of the things I like to say is that when we think about the heroic period of the civil rights movement between Brown and Selma and the Voting Rights Act, we usually think of this as a sepia-toned era filled with a happy ending, and whew, Dr. King got us through that civil rights era. So now we're all good. And Barack Obama, he completely fulfilled it because now we're in a post-racial America. I'm glad that's over. You know, I'm glad. You know, and now we can just tell our kids this great big bedtime story. After the Voting Rights Act of August 6, 1965, King becomes a pillar of fire because he realizes that democracy has to be reimagined. It has to be expansively rethought, not just for black people, but for everyone. And he starts with the labor movement, a movement for economic justice that's recruiting poor whites, Mexicans, young people were involved in gangs in Chicago, but also in Appalachia. And what's interesting about this is that King breaks with Lyndon Johnson April 4th, 1967, famous address in New York, Riverside, April 4th, 1967. And he breaks with Lyndon Johnson on not just Vietnam, but the war on poverty. King in 1963 had said that we were at such a pivotal time in American and world history, we could not afford an anemic democracy. By 67, he robustly comes out against that form of anemic democracy and says we have to have radical democracy.
Professor Peniel Joseph, historian at Tufts University, as we listen to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy. We'll play some clips now from a panel discussion that we had, including Aubrey Hendricks, who we heard from before from the New York Theological Seminary, historian Peniel Joseph there, and historian and women's studies professor Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College, and also Congress of Racial Equality Chairman Roy Innes. This begins with Aubrey Hendricks on King as a politically religious person as compared with the politically religious of today. And it gets into Innes being a civil rights leader and conservative.
He stands in juxtaposition, unfortunately, and in critical distance, unfortunately, from much of the church today. which is about, too often, it is about entertainment, it's about feeling good, it is about just us and not justice. But he also stands, I must say this, in critical distance from and in contradiction to conservative political philosophy. Because conservatism in its historical form, and you're the political scientist, so I think you'll say them right, it's about maintaining the power and wealth where it is today, conserving it, I mean, in its most basic form. Mm-hmm. And so so many of the policies that we see going on today in a party that I won't mention, we won't be partisan, but it begins with an R, coming from Ronald Reagan's Reaganomics and all through now talking about tax cuts and all that, it is about enhancing the wealth of the already rich, maintaining the wealth where it is, and in fact, Russell Kirk, in his seminal book, The Conservative Mind, Russell Kirk says that one of the tenets of conservatism is maintaining classes and orders, meaning he wants to maintain differentials of wealth and poverty in this country. So King stands then as a herald against much of what's going on today in the name of the Bible and Jesus, and a herald against what's going on so much in a body politic. And my last statement is that King and the religious right would be like oil and water. He would be outraged and horrified and sickened by the madness and the foolishness that they are purveying today.
We only have Roy Innes with us for a very short time today. All the other guests on this panel will return for another panel as we continue. But Mr. Innes, just take a couple of minutes before you leave, just 1 or 2 minutes, because you became well known again after the civil rights era for being more conservative in certain ways than other leaders from the movement. What do you think about today's economy and what policies would bring prosperity and justice? Are you a small deficit tea partier, or, you know, considering a lot of the press you got in the 90s and stuff, where are you today?
Let me shock you. I was at the board meeting of the National Rifle Association last weekend in Washington, and I was talking with Wayne LaPierre, and the same question came up about the Tea Party is. And Wayne LaPierre said, "Roy, you know, you were a Tea Partier before they knew what Tea Party was." Those who are willing to challenge orthodoxy are Tea Partiers, really. And it is too easy for media gurus to turn us against that person who challenges the status quo. The Tea Partiers aren't your enemies, not at all. I wish all of you were Tea Partiers before the Tea Party people.
Roy Innes, Tea Party supporter and civil rights leader. You don't hear that combination very often. Excerpts from our Brooklyn Museum event yesterday in honor of Martin Luther King Day, King's Dream in Today's Economy. Much more to come in a minute. More from Roy Innes and Jean Theo Harris and Aubrey Hendricks and Peniel Joseph and Melissa Harris Perry and Terrence McKnight. We'll get to some music, and I think we'll have time for some of your phone calls on some of this content. So stay with us. Excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day event at Brooklyn Museum, King's Dream and Today's Economy, continues after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy. Quick reminder, by the way, that we have A related, thoroughly unscientific poll question on our politics website, It's a Free Country, right now. The question is, do you think Martin Luther King's teachings are relevant to today's economic challenges? Are they very relevant, somewhat relevant, or not very relevant? Register your response at itsafreecountry.org, and you can hang around there to discuss the question. If you like, do you think Martin Luther King's teachings are relevant to today's economic challenges? Go to itsafreecountry.org. Our next excerpt starts with historian and women's studies professor Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College on King as a prophet, meaning he was speaking what he saw as the prophecy of truth, not speaking as a politician within the system, and freer than some to speak as a result. Then you'll also hear Roy Innes again from the Congress of Racial Equality respond.
Oftentimes we come to this holiday and we use King to say what we are doing is righteous, when in fact I think what we need to use King to do, King was a minister first, he was a prophet first, and he often called us out, and I think this is where we need to start this conversation, right, in terms of what more we had to do, right, a revolution of values, right? Over and over and over in those last years, he's talking about arrogance, American arrogance, and saying God does not take kindly to American arrogance. And so I guess part of the contradictions, part of how we look at these tensions, I would ask us to sort of start with, is to look at a king that doesn't just pat us on the back, right? That doesn't say, oh, you are good people, right? But in fact calls us to be a better, questioning, self-critical kind of people.
Don't believe for one moment that the prophet was the most popular guy in Israel. He was always jamming somebody. He was always disagreeing with the king, with the leadership. And King found himself in the same position. There were many competing philosophies and tactics and strategies. King was a prophet because in his big speech at the March in Washington, he laid down some specific changes that he's looking forward to in America. Let me confess, I didn't believe him. And I'm not the only one who didn't believe him. I'm not the only one who thought he was dreaming. Most of the Young Turks, you know how young guys are, we felt we had the solution. And it wasn't his vision that we were supporting.
Roy Innes and Jean Theo Harris, as we listen to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy. Our next excerpt starts with Christine Lewis from the Domestic Workers Union here in New York, which actually won a historic domestic workers' rights bill in the New York State Legislature last year, and that, of course, for domestic workers, people who work in other people's homes. So you will also hear Princeton professor Melissa Harris-Perry in this clip with Christine Lewis, who speaks first.
But a domestic worker is an immigrant woman of color, right? And my forebear in the 1960s, before that, actually, who were black farm workers and domestic workers in the home who worked and make cotton balls, right? But yet they weren't recompensated for their work. And after that, there happened to be like a mass migration in the late 50s and 60s. People were coming abroad to work in the service industry and what have you. And after that, there was a big influx of migration in the early 80s, actually, and early 90s, and people were coming abroad. And again, the work available to the women who came abroad, who left their families on the island, was domestic work, low-paid work. Not to say that they weren't educated by any means or form, but because of neoliberal policies that pushed the migrant workers out, right? They came to be reunified with their families and for economic power. And economic power says so, right? So they took the jobs as house cleaners, elderly caregivers, and window washers. And that was the group of women who worked in the homes, right? And they worked long, tedious hours without any basic rights and protection. Right? I could attest it. I could tell my testimony. I could tell the story. As a domestic worker coming from Trinidad in 1990, not leaving as a domestic worker, but coming here and finding myself in the confines of a home, having to take care of a 5-year-old little child on my hip, literally on my hip, and having to go out to find work by any means necessary. And so I went out, I found a wonderful family, and I worked in the home. I cleaned, I washed, and then I had to go back home to take care of my daughter. So there was a conversation which started in the playgrounds where domestic workers will all congregate. And you see those workers. You see them push the strollers. You see them push the prams on the Upper West Side and the Upper East Side and some parts of Park Slope. And I'm telling you, it's a conversation. Listen, y'all. It's a conversation we don't like to have because the domestic worker is an afterthought. You see her and then you don't. Because she work in an isolated workforce. Hello, somebody.
And you've compared the work of your union to Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign. Do you want to draw the historical connection? I mean, I think it's obvious to many of us, but do you want to put it in your words a little bit?
Definitely. Well, the sanitation workers back then were black workers, right, who were fighting to get what was theirs, which was denied to them because of a historically racist, segregationist society back down south. The face of the sanitation workers, however, changed, which became the immigrant women of color who came from Asia, she came from Africa, she came from the Caribbean, and she came from the Latino countries. Suffering and working in deplorable conditions. Nobody heard her cry. She cried in silence. And so the fight was for basic human rights. A decent living wage, fair labor standards, a time to go home when she needs to, and a time to take care of her family, except the family that she's taking care of. So yes, there is a lot of similarities between the Poor People's Campaign of yesteryear and now. Nothing much has changed, but we're just fighting to get ours.
Thank you so much.
I'm so appreciative of having both of you on the panel, in part because it tells us about the continuing legacy of King's work, but it also tells us about the blindnesses that we have in our remembrance of King. So the point, for example, that we understand labor and labor organizing almost always in the body of a man and almost always around the question of a union rather than think, and a union with a very specific and narrow kind of workplace definition of unionism, and that we have thought about black Americans as though they are a people without connection that is global, that is based in immigrant stories, that is in fact part of this narrative. And so I wanted to turn to you, Professor Theo Harris, particularly as you're thinking about Rosa Parks. How might we tell the story of King's era, of King's time, differently if we took another woman, someone who we saw and then disappeared? What if we told King's story through Parks? Might some of these sorts of stories emerge more clearly for us?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we told the story of King through Parks, we would both see 2 decades of activism that predate the boycott that focus on a number of issues. They are criminal justice issues. They are voting issues. They are the connection between political power and economic power. These are not new issues in the 60s or the 70s. These are issues in the 30s and 40s. And we would follow Mrs. Parks from the Scottsboro case, from the Recy Taylor case, from the Jeremiah Reeves case, all criminal justice issues, 40s and 50s, about finding justice for black people under the law. We would obviously have the Montgomery bus boycott, which is a urban sort of commercial boycott, right? It is taking participation out of basically saying we have economic power and we're going to use that economic power, right, to argue and to demand justice, right? But then we wouldn't stop the story there. I think when we think about Rosa Parks, we tend to, if we have a broader view of Mrs. Parks, We have a view that predates the boycott. And somehow she ends in 56 when the boycott ends December 20th. It's because she's old in the myth, right? She must have died or something, when what we know is she spends 50 years almost. 1957, her family is driven out of Montgomery. They end up in Detroit where her brother is, and she spends the next 50 years dealing with urban poverty and social justice. She works for John Conyers when he gets elected in 1964. She's working in his Detroit office. She's doing welfare. She's doing public housing. She's doing police brutality. She's doing reparations. Right? This is what Mrs. Parks is doing in the 60s and 70s and 80s. She's doing Free South Africa. And then perhaps the last political act that I can find her doing is 8 days after September 11th, Mrs. Parks, with Danny Glover, with Harry Belafonte, signs a statement saying, justice, not vengeance. We are part of an international community, and we need to think internationally. That's 2001.
Melissa Harris Perry, Jean Theo Harris, Christine Lewis, and me, in one of the panels at yesterday's Martin Luther King Day event and celebration at the Brooklyn Museum called King's Dream and Today's Economy. In a few minutes, we will have time for some phone calls. We're not going to have a lot of time for phone calls between these clips, but we're going to have a little bit of time. So if you want to react to anything that you've been hearing in the clips, or if you want to talk from your own heart or your own mind about Dr. King's relevance to today's economy, you can do so at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll put you on in a little bit. Here is another clip of historian Peniel Joseph from Tufts and Melissa Harris Perry, political science professor from Princeton, talking about Martin Luther King and Barack Obama, as well as African-American identity.
Can you connect for us how, as African-Americans are living within this legacy of King, we can start thinking of a diasporic and international and immigrant way of thinking about justice and economic questions?
No, absolutely. When we think about Dr. King, one of the things that King says in one of his last speeches, March 18th, 1968, in Memphis, when he's speaking before the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, one of the public sector workers that are now under attack as we speak in the United States, he talks about the right to protest. He talks about speaking truth to power. He says the greatness of America lies in the right to protest for right. So King is really one of the most passionate advocates, not just for unions, but also domestic workers and also welfare rights activists. One of the things that's going on in 1967, 68, is that there's a national welfare rights organization that's being organized all across the country. And it's black women who are schooling King about domestic service work. They're schooling King about what they need, not just in the Delta, but in New York City, in Boston, in Oakland, in Louisiana. When we think about Dr. King and these issues of labor and sort of diasporic blackness, Dr. King would be on the side of the Dream Act, but he also is somebody who speaks truth to power and would make many people, even in this room, feel uncomfortable. One, he criticizes labor, racism in labor, and we know there's sexism in labor, and we know there's homophobia in labor, but he also spoke truth to power. Dr. King breaks with Lyndon Johnson because he argues that Lyndon Johnson doesn't have the political or moral clarity to lead a nation that is so rich that has islands of poverty, right? So when we think about our own current predicament, when we think about this notion of an anemic democracy that Dr. King talked about, King would be a critic of the President of the United States right now. In 1967 and 68, King talked about the fact that when black people suffer from mass unemployment and mass underemployment, white people said it was a social problem. When white people suffered from it, it was a depression. And it's still the same case 42 years later. It's still the same case 42 years later. So Dr. King right now would be a civil critic of Barack Obama and the Obama administration, but he wouldn't deny or try to obscure the islands of poverty and the airtight cages of mass incarceration that plague American democracy right now. And the people who are in these floating prisons are black and brown women and men, right? So when we connect this domestic workers, when we connect what's going on with Haiti, the anti-colonial, anti-imperialist vision that King talked about so eloquently 42 years ago, he did not solve the problem, right? We can celebrate the holiday and act like we're in a post-colonial world instead of a neo-colonial world. We're in a post-imperial world instead of a neo-imperial world. We're in a post-liberal democracy instead of a neoliberal democracy. But the facts are on the ground. Things are getting worse for the people that Dr. King advocated for the most, and we need advocates. The difference between Barack Obama and Dr. King was not president of the United States. He was a civil rights leader. He could critique elected officials. We can't turn the president of the United States into a contemporary Dr. King because he can't speak truth to power. He cannot speak truth to power. He's the person who is in power. We have to have somebody who can respectfully critique Barack Obama.
Your reactions, listeners, 212-433-WNYC. We'll have a few minutes for phone calls with your reactions to these excerpts that we're playing from a Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday titled King's Dream in Today's Economy, or your own thoughts on King's Dream in Today's Economy, 212-433-9692. And we'll hear more from Peniel Joseph, last voice there, Melissa Harris-Perry, Terrence McKnight, Roy Innes, Natalia Aristizabal, Jean Theor Harris, Aubrey Hendricks, Peniel Joseph, who I mentioned, Christine Lewis. And we'll finish it up with singer Maya Azucena, who was so great at yesterday's event. Still to come. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer, on King Day here on WNYC. Brian Lehrer and WNYC. We're listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy. And we have other Martin Luther King Day programming coming up today. A beautiful symphony of brotherhood, a one-hour version of All Ears, hosted by Terrence McKnight. That's at 3 o'clock this afternoon on 93.9. We also have King's Last March, although it was one of the most challenging and controversial chapters of his career. The final year of King's life has not been the focus of as much public attention. This dramatic and illuminating documentary uses a rich mix of archival tape, oral histories, and contemporary interviews to paint a vivid picture of what may have been the most difficult year in Dr. King's life. That's 9 o'clock tonight on 93.9 FM WNYC. And at 9 o'clock tonight on AM 820, The Promised Land, with host Majora Carter, she will explore Dr. King's legacy and gauge the reach of his influence today as she talks with artists, activists, and others who have been influenced by his message. Our next clip features Princeton political science professor Melissa Harris-Perry with Christine Lewis from the Domestic Workers Union and Natalia Aristizabal Betancourt from the activist group Make the Road by Walking. She works mostly with young immigrants fighting for the DREAM Act to legalize people brought here illegally by their parents but who grew up to go to college or into the military in this country. Melissa Harris-Perry speaks first.
One of the things we rarely talk about is that King and others had to pay for the movement. A social movement is not free. And the leaders must eat, and the people must eat, and the organization has to be paid for. And there was a constant economic anxiety that was always around the movement itself, the reality of meeting up against a counter-movement that was so much more powerfully wealthy. That is the space that both of you at this moment find yourself in. What is the story of how we can think about economic justice in the context of actually trying to fund progressive social movement on the ground when it feels like the counter movements simply have much bigger bank accounts?
So I'll start by saying that they do have bigger bank accounts, but it's more of us being affected, right? And so, yes, we may not have the resources, but we have, like, our hands and we have our brains and we have our everyday lives that serve us as a platform to fight for social change and to achieve what it is that we want. So one penny by itself is not going to do anything, but if we all collectively, all the people who are being affected by an issue, come together and make it happen, then they may have all the money they want, but they're not going to have the power of the people, which to me, that's more than money. So bills like the domestic workers would have never passed, or like the wage theft would have never passed, if it's not because the people who are affected by an issue are going against all odds. I can tell you, for example, the DREAM Act, right? The DREAM Act, from the beginning, it was immigrant students trying to pass a bill that would allow them to go to college, that would allow them to work in whatever field they study. We have people telling us you can't do it. We have people saying you don't have the money to go to Washington. And we have our dreams, our hopes, and our future ahead of us. And it was quite very simple. Yes, I may not eat today, or I may not do this today because I want to save to go to Washington to go visit my legislator, but we can sleep at night because we know we're fighting with every piece in our body that we can and every resource around us that we can to find that liberation and to find that solution. And I don't know how the people who have a lot of money in the bank and go against social movements, how they sleep. But to me, it's very important to use all our resources and know that while we're laying a ground for a change that, for example, I may not see right now, I know that the little bit that I have, that my friends have and my colleagues and the youth that I work with are all putting our work and energy into that. And that has a huge value, again, that is not going to be put into a bank, but that eventually through time we're going to be able to see the change.
And I believe the four-letter word, fear, is one of the things that handicaps us in the movement with what we don't have. We are the change that we need to see in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to come together despite what we have and what we don't have. What we have, the tool, is to organize. Organize, organize. Literacy and liberation surpasses everything. And we're standing on that. And I just want to talk a little bit. Let me segue into what my brother to the end said just now. We need to overturn those tables in the temple. Because I'll tell you something right now. The bulk of the women in the house of God are the domestic workers who religiously tied every Sunday morning. Because a black woman said, "My Jesus and I, we have a good thing going on. And we will overcome by staying together." We have domestic workers united. The women are fierce, y'all. Fierce, in every sense of the word. We use nothing. And I said to my sister before, I really like to use the analogy of the widowed woman and the judge. Right? We could use it in many terms. We could dissect it how we want. But it was all about social justice. Not praying and waiting for God to hand us the money or to hand us we had no economic power. We never did. We look at Rosa Parks standing on the bus, but before Rosa Parks was a domestic worker and other domestic workers who stood on that bus. Hello. Hello. She had no money. So we can't look, we can't keep our eyes focused on the people with the clout and power, because we have the power. The people's power.
Christine Lewis from the Domestic Workers Union here in New York, in that excerpt with Natalia Aristizabal Betancourt from Make the Road by Walking and Melissa Harris Perry, Princeton Political Science Professor. We'll take some of your phone calls now. Your thoughts on the theme of our King Day event yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy, and your reaction to anything you've been hearing in the clips that we've been playing. Janine in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, good morning. This is Janine. I was very inspired with what I've just heard. I've just tuned in, as I do every day. And we, too, depend on domestic work. And I have to say, I was very, very touched by what the lady just said. And I can see it, and I'm sure there's a lot of playgroup talk on the playground. But I also wanted to point out the positive side, you know, the upshot of being able to come out of the country. So I've seen and I've worked in many different countries throughout the world that are very impoverished. And if I see women come over here and try to make it for themselves, I really admire that. And I have to say, if I, as a domestic employer, can give somebody the opportunity of employing someone, which we've done, a lady from Trinidad, a young lady from Trinidad, who was able to actually, because she worked with us, she was able to put herself through college. She was able to learn a lot of things that she'd never learned before, simply because I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I was able to help her, perhaps coach her along in times when it wasn't easy. And sometimes, yes, it is difficult to do domestic work, and it's also difficult for the person employing someone to try and be fair.
And I'm going to have to move on because our time is short, but I get your point. And they would also say, probably your employee would also say, that she came here for the opportunity.
She came and she won. She saw and she won, and that's the point I wanted to make. She put through college, and she's going to start working in the field that she chose next week.
Janine, thank you so much. Reverend Chloe in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. My name is Chloe Breyer, direct the Interfaith Center of New York. And I just was wondering if your listeners are aware that there's a very concrete piece of legislation right now asking our city to really, for those businesses that have received federal subsidies to be able to build malls and other large projects in the city, to pay their workers more than the $7 an hour minimum wage. And this is an effort that's really being trumpeted by, you know, you had 100 clergy from different faith traditions last Thursday at Convent Avenue.
Right, the living wage bill.
Yeah, exactly, and asking our mayor not to veto that effort. And
that would be a minimum
well.
Of $10 an hour for any contractor getting city work. There's also the sick time for all workers bill before the city council. Very, very controversial. And you're right. These are exactly the kinds of things that we know which side Dr. King would have been on. So I think that's a very relevant couple of things for you to bring up. Well, thank you very much. Our final clip, and thank you all for listening, and I'm sorry we don't have time for more phone calls on this today. But finally, we hear from Terrence McKnight, evening host from our classical music sister station, WQXR, introducing the singer, Maya Azucena, but first talking about an important part of the relationship between Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement generally and music. Terrence McKnight.
King was brilliant in that he knew how to galvanize musicians. I mean, when we think about some of the songs from the 50s or 60s, and I know some of you all are probably fatigued when you turn on the radio to hear the B word, the N word, words about garden tools, right? We're all kind of, we've all had enough of that, right? Well, what King did in the 50s and 60s, he was able to bring together these musicians. And so we get songs like, you know, Curtis Mayfield singing about People Get Ready. We get songs like from Sam Cooke. And these songs were used in a way that King allowed these musicians to hold fundraisers. Harry Belafonte organized rallies around music where he would raise $50,000, or he would raise large sums of money to bail King out of jail. And this is how he used these singers. And he came out after that church in Alabama was bombed. King came out and he said, you know what? I blame these Negroes who have gotten so relaxed living this life of what they call being comfortable. You know, they're driving around, they're singing to these segregated audiences, they have nice cars, and they think they're comfortable, yet the masses are struggling. So he challenged these musicians to take a different tone. And so that's why we love the music from the 60s, because King, he challenged them, and he really forced them to take sides, and he forced them to say, okay, I'm going to not be so greedy, but I'm going to make music about a larger cause. And so I think if we see any connection between King and economy and music, and if we were to move that conversation forward, I dare say that King would be on the forefront of challenging our musicians today to write about a different song.
Terrence McKnight, everybody.
And so now we're going to hear what King would call a song of resolve. We're going to hear from Brooklyn-based singer Maya Azucena. She's with Christian Verhaelen, They'll give us a song called Get It Together. We'll be back.
I want to thank Terrence for that introduction. That may be one of the most beautiful introductions I've ever had. I want to let you know it's quite an honor to be an activist through music. And it's definitely an honor to share the stage with those voices and forces that are engaging in the community and inspiring us to continue to stay alert. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Now is the time to remind America of the fierce urgency of now." And the fact that that is still so very relevant speaks to the power of truth, that the truth is always going to be relevant no matter when you drop it. And that's what I hope my music brings to every situation. Oh, say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, 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 hey. When we're going to get it together, yeah, everybody. Yeah. When we're going to get it together, yeah, everybody. When we're going to love our own culture and wear our own hair, when we're going to love our real bodies and the color of our face, when we're going to stop shooting others and hating ourselves, when we're going to protect the children and respect what came before, when we're going to get it together, yeah, everybody. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When we're going to get it together, yeah, everybody. Yeah, yeah, yeah. See, all of those dreams are not just inside. I've had mine since I was 4 feet high, singing for my parents and at every school event. Oh, I keep planting seeds wherever I go, and now when I look, I can see them grow. Oh, you need to know. Everybody, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just look in the mirror to see what you got, the future you build that no one can stop. Remember the past, our true history, how many have suffered for us to be free. See, they believed in you and me. Oh, get it together, yeah, everybody.
singer Maya Azucena with guitarist Christian Verhaelen, as we've been listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, King's Dream in Today's Economy. I thank Melissa Harris-Perry and Terrence McKnight, my co-hosts, and all our guests. More King Day programming coming up on the station with Leonard Lopate's King Day Gospel Hour, and Soundcheck at 2 o'clock looks back at the music of Marian Anderson. Coming up tomorrow on this program, WikiLeaks and social media, Tunisia and social media, the latest on how technology is transforming politics around the globe with social media visionary Clay Shirky. That's coming up tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. For now, thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Everybody, yeah, 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 yeah. When we're gonna get it together.